From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, memories of our friend and colleague Walt Bodine, the legendary broadcaster who died early this morning.
Open line with all kinds of people calling from everywhere with all kinds of viewpoints and special guests.
Residents and leaders share their visions for the arts in Kansas City and hear a story of Jewish migration in Kansas.
It's a gem, really. When you know the history of it, it reflects the movement of Jewish families from one generation into another.
Plus, Hallmark is petitioned to create a new kind of greeting card for a very difficult life event.
We noticed people stopped calling. There wasn't as much communication. It seemed like people didn't know what to say.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Our friend and colleague Walt Bodine died early this morning at the age of 92. Walt was a lifelong broadcaster, teacher, author, and friend of Kansas City. His son Marty said Walt died peacefully, surrounded by family. Laura Ziegler remembers this icon of the airwaves.
Walt Bodine was an aristocrat among newsmen and a friend to the people of Kansas City. As a reporter, he always got the story, and he usually got it first. He wrote like a poet. Here he is reporting on President Truman's visit to Kansas City during the 1951 floods.
Now a runaway barge is at this moment careening down the river, imperiling two important bridges. In Kansas City, Kansas, in the Argentine section, first to be inundated, other firemen had a long fight to bring another blaze under control.
His longtime colleague, competitor, and friend, Charles Gray, says Bodine's great gift was his ability to get at the heart of the story.
The Hyatt collapse. He was getting information on the air as to who these people were. That's what people wanted to know. Was my son there? Was my brother there? And Walt sensed that. He senses what the public needs to know. I don't think anybody comes near him.
Bodine was born at 31st and Charlotte on August 27th, 1920. He attended Longfellow Elementary and Westport High School. His curiosity, his lifelong love of the vox populi, the voice of the people, began as a soda jerk behind the counter of his family's all-night drugstore at Linwood and Troost. It was the heyday of the Pendergast machine. Bodine could eavesdrop on gamblers, prostitutes, and gangsters. After an unsuccessful stint in the theater, Walt got his first job in broadcasting. The general manager of KDRO in Sedalia gave him 1 week.
I was, in fact, talking about somebody named Joe DiMaggio and stuff like that. Friday rolled around, and he said, "Do you think you're ever going to understand the difference between the American League and the National League?" I came down with a fit of pure honesty, and I said, "I don't think so."
Bodine was fired on the spot. A couple of more broadcast jobs and a stint in the military, and it was 1947. That's the year Bodine began a 20-year career with WDAF, the NBC affiliate in Kansas City. He wore many hats there: reporter, anchor, and news director. But it was there he established his name as a pioneer among talk show hosts.
This is Walt Bodine.
And this is Gene Glenn.
And this program is Conversation.
Conversation was broadcast from the Tony Breton's restaurant at 12th in Baltimore. High-caliber guests joined them at the lunch table, authors, performers, and politicians.
And welcome to Conversation, where our guest today is Robert Kennedy, campaign manager for his brother's presidential campaign, John Kennedy, the Democratic candidate.
Walt was equally as comfortable talking with a Kennedy as he was at the counter of Town Topic, one of his favorite burger joints. He walked the streets of Independence with President Harry Truman and the streets of Kansas City with hookers and drunks. Jim Rice became a fan of Walt's as a college student and worked with him as a political consultant. He remained a lifelong friend.
He's a master conversationalist. The annoying part of being with Walt in public places, during the course of a meal, there'll be four or five people who come over. "Hi, Walt. I heard that broadcast." And Walt is absolutely courteous to a fault.
Walt Bodine's next high-profile position was night beat on radio station WHB.
on night beat.
Open line, open line.
Dial Baltimore 1-8300. Long distance may dial 816-VICTOR-2-6080.
Night beat ran from 10 p.m. until 1 in the morning, and as Walt would say, brought everyone in to talk about anything.
The bishop misquoted the president, and the gentleman from Leavenworth went ahead and embroidered it, and I've never called
my... He sat here in the listening capacity, and also one who's known Bishop Frank for a very long time. I respect him very much. I do believe, just, again, I may have to play the tape back and see if I'm... tomorrow, if I'm making sense, but I believe the statement this lady has just made is accurate.
Are you afraid of Christmas?
Oh, yeah. Who's afraid of Christmas?
Yeah. Well, I was the gentleman who called in who had just gotten out of the mental hospital.
Bodine would say when the calls got really weird, he'd start calling the show outpatient on the air. He said callers never knew the difference. Growing up as a Depression-era kid, Walt Bodine said he always felt better having more than one job at a time. For most of his career, he did. During his broadcasting years, he taught at UMKC, freelanced in advertising and political consulting. He wrote books, a column for the Squire newspaper, and did a regular commentary for Channel 9 called What Do You Say to That?
And, I heard a story on the radio where some people, I guess it was at a convention, were talking about the funeral industry and the death care industry. You know, does that spook you as much as it does me? Yep, I'll tell you. And then, well, I think it's just a matter of time till your favorite clergyman joins the trend and you start having the religion industry. Well, anyway, if they did that, we'll know who the CEO is. What do you say to that?
Alan Ball, one of Bodine's regular photographers at Channel 9, says Walt's pieces mattered.
I know we did Hillsdale Bank Barbecue out in Hillsdale, Kansas. It's a bank that the guy that's been converted to a restaurant. The next weekend, they ran out of food, and that was because of the appearance of Walt Bodine there.
The first Walt Bodine show was at KMBZ, but in 1983, then-station manager Sam Scott wooed Walt to public radio and KCUR. He loved his listener lines as much as the wide variety of guests. He cultivated a list of regular shows, the food critics, the movie critics, Nature in the City, and historic Kansas City.
And good morning to you. Welcome to the Walt Bodine Show, and today we're here with Jane Flynn.
Patty Cahill, former general manager of KCUR, learned how important Walt was to the community when she made an abysmal public relations faux pas and terminated him in the 90s. The response? Pickets and biting media editorials. She brought him back and now is glad.
Without Walt, I don't think we would have come as far as we are in terms of our influence and our part of this community.
Walt Bodine spent his whole life in Midtown Kansas City with his wife of over 50 years, Bernadine, who preceded him in death. Together they raised five children, Marty, Tom, Mary, Damian, Joseph, and Rebecca. In the introduction to his first book, Walt wrote this. If you come along with me, I'll hand you a piece of pie in one place and a piece of my mind in another. If you hit a piece of either one you don't like, jump to the next chapter, which is bound to be different. The passage seems an apt metaphor for the way Walt Bodine lived his long, engaged, and animated life. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
Every morning, open line with all kinds of people calling from everywhere with all kinds of viewpoints. And special guests, thank you very, very much for listening. Thank you very, very much for all you do.
Walt Bodine is survived by his five children, Marty, Tom, Mary, Damian, and Rebecca. His wife of four decades, Bernadine, died 10 years ago. Tune in tomorrow morning to Central Standard to hear more memories of Walt and call in with your own. And look out for an upcoming celebration of Walt's life at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. In January, the Mayor's Task Force for the Arts launched a series of meetings at community centers, libraries, and other venues to try and map out a vision for Kansas City's arts and cultural policy. Ideas and feedback are still being collected for the first comprehensive review in nearly two decades. KCUR's Laura Spencer takes a look.
It's a Monday night in January inside Arts Tech, a red brick building at the corner of 15th and Holmes. Mayor Sly James stands at the podium thanking the audience of just over 300 for their interest in the arts. About 2 years ago, Mike Burke, a former city councilman and a competitor in the mayoral race, was tapped to lead the mayor's task force for the arts.
You're here tonight so we can listen to you. That's what the mayor's task force on the arts is all about.
The crowd split into about six groups to brainstorm, and in one group, facilitator and consultant Martin Cohen started the discussion.
What is it you find that's distinctive about the cultural life of Kansas City? What are the things that come to your mind?
Freedom of choice for the arts.
The Art Deco architecture, especially on Main and all over the city, as well as our fountains.
Accessibility.
Accessibility? What kind of accessibility?
It's incredibly inviting and open to anybody. It doesn't seem in any way exclusive.
I was gonna say the tradition. We have a great arts tradition in the city.
The way that the city has always been one where the art comes from culture rather than being the culture of art, where it's easier for someone who's coming out in it, starting their own practice, has always developed. We've always developed artists. Previously, we've always shipped them off to other metropolitans. Now we're keeping them.
A lot of cross-disciplinary work is happening.
Distinctive neighborhoods.
Distinctive neighborhoods.
On the 17th floor of City Hall, a window office looks out over Bartle Hall and its stainless steel hair curlers on top. These sculptures, called Sky Stations, are in the city's public art collection. Porter Arneal is the director and public art administrator for the Kansas City Municipal Art Commission. Its primary charge, overseeing the city's 1% for art program, which sets aside part of construction costs for art. Arneal says these meetings will help chart the city's future.
We are in many ways redefining what arts and culture really is in Kansas City. We've had a tremendous decade of, you know, phenomenal things happening in the arts world here and culturally across the board, and it's still new as far as what is our future. And so we're inventing something that doesn't exist right now. And so these conversations are becoming very interesting.
I know you're still compiling the information, but you said that, you know, a few things were kind of bubbling to the surface or some conclusions.
I always speak in art terms as an old sculptor. You know, the armature is beginning to form, but we, you know, and ultimately we'll have to flesh that out and really, and the consultants are committed to present ideas and possibilities that are achievable. Some simple steps over the next year, 3 years, 5 years that the city can do to better engage. And of course, from my seat, what I'm seeing is cities across the country that have offices of cultural affairs and arts and cultural affairs divisions and that type of thing. So I think that what we also need to do is look at what are other cities doing. We are competing. Whether we like it or not, we're competing with other cities across the country. We want to attract people here, and how do we do that? And arts and culture is certainly a big part of that conversation.
There's been a lot of talk about when Rocco Landisman was here in 2010.
The third element is a local political structure that gets it, that is attuned to these issues and sees how they work and is engaged by them. And in the department of who asked me, and it's none of my business, I will say that in just about every other city that I've seen with this kind of arts presence, with this kind of commitment to the arts, with this flourishing a creative community, in just about every one of them, there is a Department of Cultural Affairs in the mayor's office.
Did that strike you, or did it strike someone else, and then that's become something that has been a topic of discussion?
I think that was some of the impetus for this. What's interesting is as I talk to my peers in Austin and Seattle and other cities that have very active arts and culture agencies, part of the ecology needs a public entity. The private entities are doing their own thing. They have their desires and wants for what the future looks like. A public piece to that is an important piece, and that's what Rocco Landisman talked about, is if the city isn't proactive at some level, and again, we don't know what that looks like yet, but to have the city become more proactive at some level is important for the broader ecology. And I think the other thing that I'm seeing, having been in this field for now 2 decades, is that other cities are engaging the arts in ways that we still haven't quite grasped yet. And so while we were visionary back in the 70s and 80s with the 1% for Art program, which is terrific, we're kind of still there, you know, and now we need to look at, okay, what are the other opportunities that the arts can serve?
So if you had to dream a little bit about the Municipal Art Commission going forward, are there certain things that you would love that the commission had more responsibility or control over?
You know, at this point, honestly, I'm not formulating any specific ideas. Bottom line for me right now is we still are defining who we are, both as a city and in arts and culture. So that's where I am, is like, let's figure out what this definition of arts and culture really is and how broad do we want it to be. It's more of a leadership initiative at this point than a reactionary effort. And so that's what I'm hoping, is that there's a paradigm shift of, oh, arts and culture really are part of our city. How do we move forward in that direction?
Municipal Art Commission Director Porter Arneal spoke with KCUR's Laura Spencer. Arneal says the mayor's task force will likely report findings and recommendations to the city council in the fall. Now, the co-chair of the task force is a woman who's been a formidable presence in Kansas City's art scene since the early 90s. Pat Jordan is best known for leading the revival of the 1912 Gem Theater on 18th and Vine. She's also opened galleries and organized art programs for youth. The Missouri Arts Council recently recognized Pat Jordan's contributions by awarding her the Leadership in the Arts Award.
So to hear more about her decades of work and her vision for the future of Kansas City and the arts, I caught up with Jordan at her office in the Vine Street Gallery, which opened in its current location in August. Her desk is situated in the middle of the first floor gallery space, surrounded by the current exhibit, The Colorful Art of Paseo High School Students. Jordan told me the arts always had a deep impact on her.
I was actually one of those kids that was always getting other children in the neighborhood together. And I remember putting together the first neighborhood play and actually writing down what each person should do and having rehearsals, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, that kind of experience never leaves you. And here we are today, some years later, still involved in the arts.
You also liked music as a child.
My goodness, you just know a lot about me, Susan. Yes, I played the piano, and I danced, and I played the cello. So, and people ask me if I still play these instruments, and no, I don't. I was a student then, and I'm still a student of the arts.
Now, you also used to be very shy, it said, but that's kind of hard to believe, thinking about all the roles that you've taken on.
What happened really to me was that when I became involved in the arts, that really opened up doors for me like nothing else had in my life. And we find that the arts does that for children even today. Through the arts, I was able to go on stage. I learned to project my voice, and the shyness went away.
Now, you serve and have served on a number of boards. Why do you think it's so important for minorities and women to be a part of the boardroom?
Because that's where all of the decisions are made. And that kind of experience is invaluable. Not only will it teach you about who it is that's out there making the decisions, but it also gives you the kind of exposure where people can know and understand what your talents are, and that kind of networking is invaluable.
Now, as you sit on these boards, you're known for your outspokenness, for your vision. Tell me about what that's like if maybe you're the only African American, you're the voice that is saying no when everyone else is saying yes.
Well, I've come to understand that there are different cultures out there. But that communication, and I learned this when I was at Southwestern Bell, communication really is the beginning of understanding. And unless you're there and unless you're present, and again, unless you're at the table, your voice will never be heard. So it's important to be there, and it's important to know when to listen and when to speak up.
What have been some of the biggest obstacles that you face trying to achieve this vision that you have for the arts in Kansas City?
Getting people to believe that East of Troost is a place where folks need to invest their dollars and their resources for various reasons, I think some of them racial and some of them geographic, those who could have not invested. And that's really the hardest challenge that we're facing today, and that is our next task.
What's the answer, though? I mean, we've been talking about the dividing line of Troost for some time. And perhaps some of the barriers have come down, but still more progress to be made.
Well, there's no question, and the problems and the challenges we face east of Troost, I think, are not that different than other cities, St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago. However, I think we are at a fabulous place and time in Kansas City. I think we have the leadership and the capability to tackle some of these problems in unique ways and make sure that our children and our children's children will not face some of these same obstacles that we are dealing with today.
What's your opinion of the art scene in Kansas City here in 2013?
We are at a place and time in Kansas City where we can become famous worldwide for the arts assets that we have here. Our main challenge is that we have to figure out how to come out of this shell and figure out ways in which we can begin to tell the world about these hidden jewels.
So when you think about the art scene here in Kansas City and you think about African American artists, what's that scene like?
There again, Susan, I mean, these are untold stories that are here. Since I've opened in August, I have been receiving phone calls from community leaders and others and artists themselves with referrals about or questions about how it is that they can exhibit here in this space. I am now booked through June of 2015. The talent that is here is just absolutely amazing.
Well, one of the things you've been quoted as talking about is just the dearth of multicultural arts programming here in Kansas City. What are the causes of that, and what are some solutions?
I think historically, the majority audience has not paid attention to minority artists and minority talent. I think that one of our challenges is to make sure that these artists are exhibited and that as many people as possible find out and begin to understand that they are here and that they are talented and that they need to be recognized.
Now, one of the things you always associate when you talk about arts in Kansas City is jazz, of course. Now, how much should Kansas City simply just rely on its jazz identity, and how much should an arts focus be expanded?
Well, we've got to understand that, of course, there are different genres of the arts. And even though we want to, of course, celebrate our jazz history, and we haven't done enough even as it relates to that, we have to remember that the fabric is broad and wide and that there are musicians and singers and visual artists of all types who also need to be recognized as well.
What would you say are the major barriers for African-American artists in Kansas City? You mentioned that perhaps audiences aren't quite prepared or ready to embrace them. Are there other barriers?
One of the primary barriers is the fact that artists, not just African-American artists, but artists in general, and really people, very talented people, really just want to practice their craft, Susan, and they don't really want to market themselves. And so what we are having to do, of course, is to figure out ways that we can instruct them to market themselves better and how it is that we can assist them in doing that and do this for them. So those are the kinds of tasks that we are employing now to assist them.
Well, you know, you see a lot of art incubators popping up in the Crossroads District. Do African American and other artists of color have enough in the way of support in terms of things like arts incubators and places like that where they can pursue their art?
No, but there, I tell you what, there's plenty of room on the east side. And that's one of the reasons why I'm getting involved in housing and community development more, because I think that artists of color, women artists, need to be located in our neighborhoods. And I would love for them to contact me so we can talk more about having studio space and live workspace east of Troost.
Let's talk 18th and Vine. You've been involved over the years in the historic 18th and Vine area. Some would say that the area hasn't progressed as much as people think it should. What do you think have been some of the factors?
Well, actually, I take issue with that because if you look back historically, I started working on the Jim Theater Project in 1989. We opened in 1997. Well, in actuality, in 1997, downtown was barely being thought of as a place for revitalization. So in actuality, we were far ahead of the curve, and we are to be applauded. And all of those, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, who was then our mayor, and others who were involved, need to be applauded for supporting something that was very, in essence, forward-thinking. The history and that the Jim Theater was, along with the Jazz Museum and the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, is a true catalyst for revitalization. When you see those lights that are on and you know that there are children, one of whom told me, Susan, one day that his goal in life was to perform on the Jim Theater stage, which he did get to do, then you know that it really was and is all worth it.
Any regrets?
My mother told me that she didn't want me to sing. I was also singing when I was in high school, and I was asked to join a band, and she was horrified at that and said I needed to get a good paying job. And so you know what? My only regret was that I did not continue my singing career. So I have vowed to, when I retire, whenever that is, I want to sing the blues.
Pat Jordan, thank you for being with us on Casey Currents today.
Thank you, Susan. It was delightful.
Pat Jordan is president of the GEM Cultural and Educational Center.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. It seems like there's a greeting card for everything these days.
Everyone's nervous going back to school.
General Crafts U Enterprise. Spock here. Happy holidays.
We're friends.
Yeah.
This Valentine's Day, play it safe. With the Hallmark mix.
Hallmark has a selection of cards for people who just lost their jobs.
Yes, there are even cards for losing your job. But what about a card for being in hospice or at the end stages of life? That's the idea of a high-profile patient advocate who's turned her attention to Kansas City, because of Hallmark, of course. But as KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, such a concept is not so easy to realize.
Regina Holiday is a patient activist in Washington, D.C. She mostly focuses on access to health data, and her work has caught the attention of national leaders like the health IT coordinator for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But Holiday wasn't always involved in D.C. She has fond memories of living in Kansas about 15 years ago.
I once ran the Jayhawk bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Her husband, Fred, was earning a Ph.D. in film studies at KU.
His dissertation was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
He then taught film at American University in Washington. But in 2009, he fell ill quickly. When he was hospitalized, they learned he was at the end stages of kidney cancer.
And so we had this roller coaster of care for 2 months, and then it led to hospice.
Holiday says it was such a hard time, and not just because her husband was dying, but because of how isolated they felt, even from those who cared about them.
we noticed people stopped calling. There wasn't as much communication. It seemed like people didn't know what to say. And you'd occasionally get like a thinking of you or a blank card, or sadly, we even got a couple sympathies. And that was the final month of his life.
Holiday's husband died that spring. But over time, she realized their experience underscored a much larger problem in society.
People don't talk about death very much. People don't want to say the word, the big D word, or talk about that what's going to happen next. And because of that, we actually often leave our dying friends and family alone. And a lot of people wait till it's far too late to have a call or a card or a visit.
That was really troubling to her. It still is. Holiday then thought about her Jayhawk bookstore days, and one of the items that took up a big portion of the store.
There was a whole bunch of cards. We had a huge footprint of cards.
She got to thinking, what if there were another section next to the birthday and graduation cards?
They also have headers that said hospice. I think that starts the conversation. And I thought it could be incredibly powerful.
So she turned to an obvious source.
Hey, what a card can say for Yeti.
And petitioned the largest greeting card company in the U.S., headquartered here in Kansas City.
I'm going to keep this forever.
Hey, what a Hallmark card can do.
I think at any given time, we probably have 20,000 different cards out there.
Linda O'Dell is a spokesperson for Hallmark.
There are lots of cards that are about offering care and concern and hoping for a good day and praying for you.
O'Dell says about 15 years ago, Hallmark came out with a line of cards for difficult situations. There have been several variations since then. O'Dell's familiar with Regina Holiday's recent efforts, and the company has issued a response. On the one hand, it made them realize how hard it was to find their cards that might be appropriate for hospice situations. In fact, if you typed in end of life into Hallmark's online search engine, cards from the Tree of Life line would come up.
So, cards that were appropriate for bat mitzvah.
Whoops.
We fixed those things.
But O'Dell says creating an overt hospice card line is more complicated. O'Dell admires Holiday's efforts and recognizes that each person's experience is different. But here's the thing. Hallmark has already thought about hospice cards.
Hallmark exists to help people make positive emotional connections with one another. As such, we obviously are always paying attention to what's going on in society and what people are saying to each other. But we are a reflection of that conversation. We're not pushing the conversation forward.
O'Dell says they're always listening, but they're listening to a lot of people.
This is a very sensitive topic, and we have to be equally alert to those who would feel like it was really inappropriate to have cards that overtly speak to hospice and end of life.
Have you heard that perspective as well?
Absolutely.
I think they were a little afraid of it from a business perspective, and I get that.
Myra Christopher is founding director of the Center for Practical Bioethics in Kansas City. She's deeply involved in national policy discussions around end-of-life care. Back in the 90s, Christopher met with members of Hallmark's creative team to discuss the very same thing that Holiday is now pushing for, designing end-of-life and hospice-themed cards.
Well, it's really fascinating. I mean, these are really smart people. And the team we met with mostly were really young people. And, you know, we sat around a big conference table and we just brainstormed. And
Christopher doesn't recall specifics of what happened next, except the concept just wasn't in line with Hallmark's plans at that point. To be clear, Christopher loves Hallmark and their cards. Her center has led trainings for Hallmark employees, and the company has donated to the center. Christopher's familiar with Holiday, too. She wasn't aware of her greeting card efforts until we spoke, but totally understands where Holiday's coming from.
There is a real, really urgent need for honest, candid discussion at every level in our society about these issues. I just had a conversation this week with a friend, a quite elderly friend, where I said to her, I hope that your death is not prolonged and that your passing is peaceful. And she said, I wish people would say that to me instead of saying, oh, we hope you get better.
So I asked Christopher what she and other researchers have found are ways to help with this, especially on a personal level. I also asked Regina Holiday what she thinks, what kinds of messages she would want to see in cards. And the answers I got from both of them, even though the conversations were different, had a lot of similarities.
One of the hardest things is the wish that you could take this. That you could take this from them. So, a card that will address that.
I want you to know how much I have loved and valued you.
And just come right out and say it.
What you've meant to me in my life, and that I'm going to miss you.
I'll miss you.
And that I'm grateful for you.
Those kind of statements.
We need to remember that this is such a precious time in someone's life. And there can be great joy, great meaning, great creativity.
You know, the kind of things that you want to hear that open up the bridges, that open up the conversation that's just missing right now.
Holiday says funny approach could be powerful too, if that person has a sense of humor. Christopher admits that in all her years doing this work, reaching out to someone can still be hard, even if there is a card. She says in the end, it's not about what's written or what's said, but about being there. Even a note that really doesn't say anything at all, she says, except thinking of you, with your name on it, would be a blessing and a gift. Reporting for Casey Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, six JJ's restaurant employees sued the gas company. Two area airport control towers were on the federal closing list, and Mayor Sly James stayed calm under surprise attack. KCUR Steve Bell looks back at those and other top stories on the Weekend News Review.
Mayor Sly James's State of the City message was upstaged by a protester who grabbed the mic, spewing expletives still tackled. The mayor said he never felt endangered, but the criticism of the city was unfair.
When we're robbing Peter to pay Paul, we're doing as much as we possibly can.
The interrupter, Darren Black, was charged with two misdemeanors. The first lawsuit was filed over the explosion and fire at JJ's restaurant on the plaza. Six employees who were injured are suing Time Warner, Missouri Gas Energy, contractor Heartland Midwest, two utility line locating and marking services, and one MGE employee. The suit charges, among other things, that the location of the gas line was not properly marked, no evacuation was conducted, and employees were told none was needed. Negro League Baseball Museum President Bob Kendrick was elated when producers announced a Kansas City pre-release showing of a new movie about Jackie Robinson.
It was a little bit of fortune, a little bit of ingenuity, a lot of that all goes together, and a lot of luck.
Harrison Ford is scheduled to appear at the April event. He plays Dodgers manager Branch Rickey, who hired Robinson away from the Kansas City Monarchs, breaking the Major League Baseball color line. A federal judge invalidated a Missouri law that allowed any employer with a moral objection to ignore the birth control mandate of the Affordable Care Act. Brent Butler is with the insurance company Coalition that filed the suit.
If you follow the federal law, you're violating state law. If you follow state law, you're violating federal law. So that's why the challenge was made, so that they could do business, essentially.
The Missouri Supreme Court struck down MOSIRA, a science and technology incentive fund, because the bill creating it had more than one subject. Groups that challenged it were concerned that some of the money could go for embryonic stem cell research. Several area Kansas communities opposed a bill forbidding local governments from banning open carry of firearms. Mike Taylor spoke for Kansas City, Kansas.
We don't want you to strap a gun on your hip and be able to walk down Main Street. We think we have the right to regulate that.
Conservatives and libertarians say the local laws violate the Second Amendment. Olathe's Lance Kinzer spoke for a 70-page abortion bill that passed the Kansas House.
Every Kansas taxpayer will be able to know with a high degree of certainty that none of their tax dollars are being used to promote the performance of abortion.
Friday, a Senate committee approved the bill, which forbids personal medical deductions for abortions and mandates that doctors warn patients that abortion may cause breast cancer. The American Cancer Society says it doesn't. The legislature sent Governor Brown back a bill ending payroll deductions for public employee unions for political causes, but backed off on two bills limiting teachers' union bargaining, to which top Senate Democrat Anthony Hensley said,
postponing any action on these bills is an indication that there was some very serious resistance in the education community.
Both houses passed budget bills, and a committee began working on a compromise. Thursday, two people jumped from the Kit Bond Bridge and were never found. Police believe they were a man and his adult daughter who lived in a rural area south of Kansas City. Friday, the FAA announced control towers to be closed because of sequestration. They included the ones at Johnson County's Industrial and New Century airports. This is KCUR.
This week during Passover, Jewish communities around the world gather to retell one of the oldest tales in the world, the biblical story of Exodus. Today, we tell a story from a more recent chapter of Jewish history and closer to home. The Lawrence Jewish Community Congregation recently succeeded in getting a 19th century cemetery in Eudora, Kansas, listed on the National Register of Historic Places. It's the last trace of a pioneering Jewish community that helped found the tiny town. Alex Smith reports that for them, Eudora was once a promised land.
If you could travel back to eastern Kansas in the 1850s, you might see a scene familiar from lots of movies and books, a group of hardy travelers venturing west in search of a better life. But these weren't homesteaders or gold prospectors. They were a small Orthodox Jewish community who came to the frontier from Chicago. As KU American Studies professor David Katzman explains, these entrepreneurs came to Kansas after finding it nearly impossible to start a business in Chicago.
You might be a peddler rather than being a storekeeper. So the idea of the West was that it offered an opportunity to actually open and run a store rather than being an itinerant peddler, which many Jewish merchants and non-Jews were at the time.
In 1854, the Kansas Territory was open to settlement, and